The brutal engagement had lasted almost 4 hours, lasted until all four Carizian galleons had been completely dismasted, until their sides had been beaten in by point-blank cannon fire, until blood ran from their scuppers, and the remaining gunners could scarcely serve their pieces because of the bodies in their way. They'd inflicted as many casualties as they'd taken, Merlin was certain of that, but their own losses were heartbreaking. It was impossible to be positive yet, even with the Snarks, but he would be surprised if Gwilym Manthir's crews hadn't taken at least 60% casualties before it was all over. He hoped he was overestimating, that the sheer fury of the engagement had caused him to be too pessimistic. Unfortunately, he couldn't convince himself he had been. Nor had Dancer and her three consorts been Manthir's only losses. HMS Silverload had been driven ashore and wrecked at the height of the storm. Half her crew had been lost when she drove onto the rocks amid 35-foot waves. The other half had been rounded up by the Harchong army, who'd killed over half of the survivors in the process. HMS Defense had simply foundered, driven over on her beam ends by a huge sea no one could have seen or avoided in the darkness. She'd filled almost instantly and gone down with her entire company. And Dagger had ultimately been cornered against a lee shore by a trio of Thirsk's galleons. Forced to fight against such heavy odds, she'd given a good account of herself before she was forced to surrender. But it was obvious the Doloran Navy's days of letting itself be bullied into allowing Karras to dictate the terms of battle were over. And finally, HMS Howell Bay and HMS North Bay were still deep inside the Gulf of Dolar, trying to work their separate ways back out again without being intercepted. Of Gwilym Manthir's 19 galleons, including the captured Prince of Dolar, 8 had been captured or destroyed by the storm, and 2 might yet be intercepted before they could break free of the gulf. The others had reached Claw Island by now, or would reach it shortly, and Captain Powell, the senior officer left, had received Gwilym Manthir's final orders. Given the losses he'd already anticipated, and the obvious Doloran strength in the western portion of the Gulf of Dolar, those instructions had been clear, concise, and unwavering. It was only a matter of time, and not much of that, before Thirsk moved to attack Claw Island. So it was time to go, and Powell was ordered to evacuate the Marines and all of the transports, covered by the remaining galleons. Instead of heading east to return to Old Karras, however, he was to sail west to Chisholm. It would actually be a shorter journey, and given the Doloran performance, reinforcing Chisholm had just become a significantly higher priority. Yet the truth remained that the Carizian expedition wasn't simply withdrawing, its mission accomplished. Oh, it would have been withdrawing even without the storm. And if it had, if Manthir had evacuated Claw Island as planned and sailed home again, it would have been a very different matter. But that wasn't what had happened. For the first time, one of the Church's subject navies had scored an unambiguous victory over the Imperial Carizian Navy. What had happened off Dragon Island could be argued either way, claimed as a tactical victory by either side. What had happened in the Harchong Narrows could not. And the truth is, Merlin told himself unflinchingly, that Thirsk damned well earned that victory. The weather might have let him collect it, but it's entirely possible we would have gotten hurt even worse if not for the storm. He was closer behind Gwilym than Gwilym realized, and even if his crews were less disciplined than he might have wished, they were full of fight. If he'd managed to get all 42 of his ships into the approaches to Claw Island the way he'd planned, especially with him right there to impose tactical discipline, while Gwilym had to claw his way out with only 19 warships and all those transports to protect, Manthir's decision to fight had prevented that much, at least. In what Merlin privately considered to be Thirsk's only real mistake of the entire campaign, the Dolaran Earl had decided to take his own damaged ships and their prizes to Yushai and Shui Bay for repairs before resuming his offensive. In some ways, given the fact that he didn't know where Manthir's other galleons were, it had made sense to avoid the risk that his cripples and captures might be pounced upon by undamaged Carizian warships. In fact, though, Merlin was certain Thirsk's decision had been shaped more by a desire to show Yushai what the Dolaran Navy had done to the squadron which had attacked the city, and to ensure that his prizes did get home to Gorath Bay in the end. Not just because they were his trophies either, although Merlin never doubted Thirsk had at least enough of common human vanity to want to display his prizes as exactly that. No. Those captured Carizian ships were going to be the proof his methods, his strategy, and his tactics actually worked. That Carizian squadrons could be defeated, and that he was the admiral who could do the defeating. "Maybe I should reconsider that decision not to simply assassinate him," he thought. He didn't want to get into the habit of doing things like that, but still. "At least Sir Gwilym's still alive," Charlian said into the stillness. She was the only member of the conversation who'd never gotten to know Manthir personally, but what she had known about him she'd liked. Now she looked across the bassinet at her husband and reached out to lay a comforting hand on his knee. "We have that much," she reminded him. "Yes." He covered her hand with his own, then inhaled deeply and smiled at her. "Yes, we do. And it looks as if Thirsk has forgiven me for marooning him and his men on Armageddon Reef after Crag Reach." He actually managed a chuckle, and Merlin snorted mentally. He'd been there when Caleb delivered his ultimatum to Thirsk, and he knew the Emperor had been at least a little anxious about how Thirsk might react the first time Carizians had to surrender to him. In the event, he'd treated Manthir and his officers and men with rigorous propriety under the Safeholdian customs of war. His healers had tended Manthir's wounded as conscientiously as they had looked after their own, and the surviving officers had been shown every courtesy by their captors. To be honest, that was exactly what Merlin had expected out of Thirsk, although it was a vast relief to have his expectations confirmed. "And it would be an even vaster relief if I could be certain Thirsk was going to be allowed to hang on to them," he thought grimly. "Which is another reason not to assassinate him, dammit." He snorted to himself, wondering why it was that he found the thought of assassinating someone he respected, even admired, so repugnant when he would have killed the same man in open battle with barely a qualm. "I guess everyone has to have a sticking point somewhere, and it's not as if there weren't logical reasons not to kill him off. If we did, and if it was an obvious assassination, or even something Clinton could simply claim might have been an assassination, it would only reinforce the suspicions of everyone who thinks Caleb had Hector murdered. But even that's not the worst of it. Killing him off would only make room for someone else, probably one of his disciples, someone who's already imbibed his own theories and plans, like Holland. They might not be quite as good as he is, but they'd probably be good enough. And for another, he has treated his prisoners decently, at least so far. Can we afford to kill off someone on the other side who seems determined to do that? Especially in the wake of what Clinton did to the Wilsons and their friends?" That was what worried him most at the moment, he admitted to himself. Would Thirsk be allowed to retain possession of his prisoners? Or would someone else be given charge of them? "For the first time, the Church has the opportunity to get its hands on an entire clutch of Carizian heretics, and I hope to God they don't do what I'm afraid they might. Clinton's purge of the vicarate was bad enough. If he decides to turn this into the kind of religious war old Earth saw entirely too many of, with atrocities provoking counter-atrocities, even from Carizians. How do you think Clinton's going to respond to this, Merlin? Lock Island asked, almost as if he'd been reading Merlin's mind, and Merlin shrugged. I don't know, he said honestly. On so many levels, I don't know. But I do know one thing. What? Caleb asked when he paused. I know we'd damned well better get Seamount and Hausman started, cranking out those new shells of theirs, Merlin told him. September, Year of God, 894. 1. Sir Corin Garvey's townhouse and Royal Palace, City of Manchir, Princedom of Coruscant. Sir Corin Garvey walked into his study, carrying a glass of Chisomian whiskey, and crossed to his desk. He used his free hand to turn up the wick on the oil lamp one of the servants had lit earlier in the evening, and started to set down the whiskey, then stopped abruptly. There was an envelope on his desk. He hadn't left it there. In fact, he'd never seen it before. On the other hand, he did recognize the handwriting. That he'd seen before. Well, he thought after a moment, at least this time there's no broken glass. He finished setting down the whiskey and seated himself. He gazed at the envelope for a few more seconds, then shrugged and picked it up. As the last time, there were several sheets of paper, but instead of the pair of hand-drawn maps which had accompanied the first letter, there were three. Not of secret rooms in monasteries this time, but of the city of Talitha in the Earldom of Stormkeep. One was a precisely annotated street map indicating names and addresses. He recognized some of the names already, others he'd never heard of, but he suspected that when he got around to the rest of the letter, he'd find out who they were. The second map was a diagram of Stormhouse, the Earl of Stormkeep's residence, this one marked with neat arrows indicating concealed caches of correspondence and other documentary evidence, and one small suite simply marked the Bishop Executor's rooms. And the third... His eyes lit as he saw the warehouses and followed more neat arrows to the areas in which camouflaged crates, which had arrived in Coruscant by way of Zebediah, had been stored. "You know, I didn't really believe you when you told me about all this, Sajan Merlin," he thought, sipping whiskey before he started reading the letter itself. "Oh, I guess I did intellectually, but deep inside... I never really believed there truly was this vast network of Sajans scattered around the world. But..." He looked around the study, looked at the closed and locked glass doors leading to the central garden, thought about the sentries around the townhouse. "I don't see who else could have gotten in here and left this for me." He snorted a laugh, took another sip, then stood and crossed back to the study door. He opened it and looked out at the sentry outside it. "I need some messengers, Corporal."
"Of course, sir. How many?"
"Well, let me see. I need one to Sir Charles Doyle, one to my father, one to Earl Tartarian, and one to Viceroy General Sherman." The Corporal's eyes had widened a bit farther with each name, but he only nodded, and Garvey smiled at him. "Tell Major Niklos I said to pick good, reliable men he knows will keep their mouths shut. I'll have notes for them to deliver by the time they can assemble here. Oh, and find Yeoman Alston. I'll want him, and he'll want to be here."
"Yes, sir," the sentry said, and dashed off down the hallway. Garvey
watched him go, then went and sat behind his desk, pulled several sheets of stationery out of a drawer, dipped a pen, and began writing.
"What's this all about, Corin?" Sir Rysel Garvey grumbled as he marched into the meeting chamber. "I'd just settled in for the evening when your man came thundering on the front door."
"I apologize for disturbing you, Father, but something's come up."
"Damn it, you know how I hate those words," the Earl of Anvilrock groused, crossing to his chair at the council table. "Something has been coming up at the most inconvenient possible moment for the last 2 damned years."
He plunked himself down, leaned back, and regarded his eldest son and the apple of his eye with remarkably scant favor. His august and trusted fellow counselor, Earl Tartarian, chuckled, and Anvilrock turned his glower upon him.
"I suppose you think this is humorous?" he demanded, his tone irate, although there might have been just a spark of amusement in his eyes. "I happen to know that you usually stay up until all hours anyway, instead of going to bed at a sane hour. You probably hadn't even had supper yet when this young jackanapes note reached you." "Of course I hadn't," Tartarian soothed. "Whatever you like, Rysel. And now, if you've got that out of your system, perhaps we could get down to business." "Spoil sport," Anvilrock muttered, but he also turned his attention back to his son. "All right, Corin," he said in quite a different tone. "What is it?"
"I just received a note of my own, father," Garvai replied. "The one Sajan Merlin warned me I might be receiving."
"Ah?" Anvilrock sat up straighter, his eyes narrowing. "You're certain this is really from one of Merlin's mysterious assistants, Corin?"
Tartarian sounded a bit cautious, and Garvai didn't blame him.
"I don't see how anyone but another Sajan could have delivered it the way it was delivered," Garvai shrugged. "It was on my desk in my locked study when I walked in after dinner, my lord. And there's enough sensitive material in that study that it's under guard day and night. But someone got in, anyway. I'm not going to say it would have been impossible for someone other than a Sajan to pull that off, but it would certainly have been difficult. And Charles..." He twitched his head towards the foot of the table, where Charles Doyle was poring over the letter, even as he spoke. "Is confident what he's seen so far is genuine. You know we've been doing a little checking of our own ever since Sajan Merlin warned us about this northern conspiracy of his. We haven't wanted to overset any potato carts or step on any of the Sajan's associates' toes, so we haven't pushed too hard. Everything we've turned up, though, is consistent with this letter."
"I see." Tartarian looked at Anvilrock. "Rysel?" "If Corin and Charles are satisfied it's genuine, so am I."
Anvilrock's expression was as grim as Tartarian remembered ever having seen it.
"And to be honest, I'm just as glad to hear it. I want these bastards, Terrell. I want them badly."
Garvai watched his father's expression as well, marveling at how Anvilrock's attitudes had altered since he'd unwillingly assumed the role of the absent Prince Divan's regent. The Earl was no happier than he had been at the notion that his princedom had been conquered by a foreign power, and as the man who'd commanded Prince Hector's army, he continued to take that conquest as a personal failure. At the same time, however, it was obvious he'd come to genuinely accept that the Carizian occupiers were doing their best to be no more repressive than they had to. And Garvai knew, little though his father cared to admit it, Anvilrock had grudgingly, against his will, fighting every inch of the way, come to accept that Caleb of Carus and Charlion of Chisholm were better rulers than Hector had been as well.
"Oh, how he fought that one," Garvai thought ruefully. "It really stuck in his craw. And I suppose I understand that, too. They were cousins, and here at home, at least, Hector always tried to ride with a light rein. But you were too close to him, father, weren't you? You knew what he was like when it came to the great game, just like you knew, as well as I did, who really started the conflict between Coruscant and Carus. And it wasn't Harald, was it?"
Even now, Sir Corin Garvai wasn't even tempted to think of his father as a Carizian partisan. In fact, the mind boggled at the concept. But especially since Archbishop Michael's visit, Anvilrock had at least accepted that Carus was trying to make a bad situation better. And, Garvai suspected, while the Earl might not yet have worked his way around to considering himself a Carisian subject, he had found himself much more firmly in agreement with the Church of Carus's doctrine, and the growing support that doctrine was finding among Coruscant's own reformists than he'd ever anticipated.
"Which is the real reason you want those bastards, Father?" Garvai thought affectionately. "Because you don't trust them as far as you could spit up wind. Because you know damned well people like Craggy Hill and Barkor and Zebediah aren't trying to make a bad situation better, unless they can do better for themselves in the process."
"Your note said you were informing the Viceroy General," his father said, and he nodded.
"Yes, Father," he shrugged slightly. "First, because it was my responsibility to inform him, and second, because I figured it was entirely possible he was going to get a note of his own."
Garvai smiled crookedly. "Under the circumstances, it seemed the most prudent thing to do. Although I did tell him I'd be meeting with you and Earl Tatarian, and that you two would advise him of the Regency Council's decision in this matter."
"Tactful sort, aren't you?" his father observed, then looked at Tartarian. "Well, Tarrell, I don't see that we have a lot of deciding to do here, despite Corrin's efforts to spare our feelings. And I'm not sure I see any reason to go convening the entire council, either. This clearly comes under the executive authority of the Crown, which is presently vested in me as regent. Besides, we have, as Corrin just pointed out, an obligation to inform Chairman and cooperate with him fully in this matter." He grimaced. "Comes with all those oaths the bunch of us in Parliament swore to Caleb and Charlian. Would you agree?"
"With the observation that nobody in Zion or the Temple is ever going to accept those oaths as binding, yes,"
Tartarian said mildly.
"Ha!"
Anvil Rock snorted contemptuously and shook his head.
"Of course they aren't. But the truth is, Tarrell, I've discovered I really don't give a fart for the damned group of four anymore. This whole mess is that lizard-loving bastard Clinton's fault in the first damned place. And Grand Inquisitor or no, if he really gives a damn what God wants, I'm a frigging Harchong Grand Duke."
Garvai's eyes widened. Despite his own earlier thoughts about Anvil Rock's attitude towards the Church of Carus, that was, by any measure, the strongest statement his father had ever made about the Temple's current leadership. Yet even though he'd never expected to hear it, what surprised him the most was that he felt so little surprise when the words were actually said. He looked at Tartarian and felt another little spasm of surprise, because Tartarian was actually smiling at Anvil Rock.
"Took you a little while to figure that out, did it, Rysel?"
"His mother," Anvil Rock twitched a thumb in his son's direction, "always did say I could be a little slow. But I'll tell you this, Tarrell, it'll be a cold day in hell when you see someone like Grand Vicar Eric, or that murderous asshole Clinton, trekking all the way out to some place like Coruscant. You think they give a spider-rat's arse what happens to us out here?"
"Of course not," Tartarian said quietly. "I never did. On the other hand, I never thought there was any way to change that either."
"Well, neither did I, really," Anvil Rock admitted. "And I didn't think there was when Caleb sailed over here from Old Carus and kicked our arses up between our ears, either. Religious reform? Dragon shit. Old-fashioned imperial politics with a new justification. That's what it was, and I knew it. I'm still not entirely ready to give up on that interpretation, either, but..."
"But then there's Archbishop Michael, isn't there?"
Tartarian finished for him in a soft voice, and Anvil Rock nodded.
"There's Archbishop Michael, and there's priests like Father Timon, and there's the cold-blooded bastards who murder priests like Father Timon. Bastards like Jaspar Clinton, who murder children and call it God's will."
Muscles bunched in Anvil Rock's jaw for a moment, and then he closed his eyes, inhaled deeply, and gave himself a shake. When he opened his eyes again, the jaw muscles had relaxed once more, and he smiled crookedly.
"I don't think Caleb Armach is the Archangel Langhorne come back in glory, but I do think he's a basically good young man doing the best he can in one hell of a messy situation. A young man who refused to just roll over and die when the group of four decided to destroy his kingdom. I also think Clintan and the Inquisition have shown their true colors now. And I'll tell you this right now, Tarrell. I'll side with anyone this side of Shan Wei herself who's willing to stand up to someone like that."
2. City of Talitha, Talith Bay, Earldom of Stormkeep, Princedom of Coruscant. There was nothing remarkable about the two merchant galleons lying to anchor well out from the harborside quays of the city of Talitha. They'd arrived separately, hours apart, one flying the house flag of a rather disreputable Manchir trading house, and the other of Chisomian registry. They'd anchored within a few hundred yards of one another, then proceeded to ignore each other as they awaited their own turns to go along quayside or lighter their cargo ashore. Neither seemed in any particular hurry, since their skippers hadn't made any special push to arrange to land their cargoes, but no one in Talitha cared particularly about that. In fact, no one in Talitha paid them the slightest mind as they lay there, a handful of men moving about their decks, watching darkness settle slowly over the bay. Lights began to glow here and there ashore, nothing like the illumination one might have seen out of Telesburg or Chiraeth or even Manchir, but glittering like beached stars nonetheless. They seemed even brighter tonight than they might have been otherwise, since there happened to be no moon. Complete darkness closed in, turning the galleons into all but invisible black blots against the only slightly brighter water. Stars came out overhead, briefly mirrored in the oily smooth swell, but even as they appeared, clouds began sweeping in from the east. This, Sir Corin Garvey thought, standing on the quarterdeck of one of those galleons and watching the incoming clouds steadily erase the stars, is ridiculous. I'm willing to believe in Sajans, I guess, and I suppose, especially after listening to Father talk about conversions, I can accept that God is on Archbishop Michael's side. That's not the same thing as being on Caleb's side, though, and even if it were, how did even a Sajan arrange a night like this? It's like the archangels delivered the damned weather to order. Under the circumstances, it was a reasonable enough question. Then again, Garvey didn't know about snarks, or an AI named Owl, or the meteorological projections he could make. Nor did he have any idea that Merlin Athrawis, thousands of miles away in Telesburg, could arrange to have one of Al's remotes quietly deliver his message on a timetable designed to get Garvey and his raiders here at precisely this time. Actually, Merlin had aimed for any spot in a 4-day window. In fact, he'd been prepared to settle for missing the window completely, given the vagaries of wind, weather, and the unpredictable interference of Murphy. It had seemed worth shooting for, though, and Garvey and Howell Cherman had surprised him with how quickly they'd moved. They'd been fortunate with the wind on their passage from Manchir as well. Which was how Sir Corin Garvey found himself watching the galleons sway their boats, rather larger and more numerous than most merchant galleons might have carried if anyone had noticed, over the side on a calm, windless night, blacker than the inside of an old boot. He was confident they would have managed under other weather conditions, but he wasn't about to look a gift dragon in the mouth when God decided to give him perfect weather conditions, even if he didn't know how the Sajans had arranged it. Now he waited as the first wave of Imperial Carizian Marines and Coruscantian Guardsmen, who'd hidden below decks all day, swarmed quietly up out of the galleon's hatches and then down into the waiting boats. In all, there were almost 1,000 men spread between the two merchantmen. Even with a larger-than-usual complement of boats, they couldn't land that many troops at once. On the other hand, after carefully studying charts of the harbor and the maps which had accompanied the mysterious letter, Garvai and Major Daniel Porter, the senior Marine Company commander, had picked likely spots to land the first wave. Garvai waited until the last man, but one, of the first wave had climbed down, then dropped lightly over the galleon's side himself. He slid down the rope until Yeoman Alston, waiting below, reached up and grabbed the heel of one boot. Alston guided his foot down to one of the boat's thwarts, and Garvai released the rope and dropped the last inch or so.
"All right," he said quietly. "Let's go."
Four boats rowed silently, oarlocks muffled, across Talith Bay. The city's lights offered a sufficient navigation beacon for inexperienced Imperial Navy coxswains. In fact, the hard part was less finding their way to their destination than making certain they gave other anchored vessels a sufficiently wide berth. It was no part of Garvai and Porter's plans for some civilian anchor watch to hail them and raise any sort of alarm ashore. Nothing of the sort happened, and Garvai's boat slid quietly under one of the city's older, more rickety piers. It was almost low water, and he was pleased to see his mysterious correspondence notes were indeed accurate. The receding tide had exposed a wide expanse of rocky shingle, roomy enough for half again as many men as he'd brought with him, nestled in the ink-black shadow of the abandoned pier. The first two boats were already disembarking their passengers, a full company of guardsmen, equipped with their personal weapons and a dozen bullseye lanterns with firmly closed sides, when Garvai stepped ashore. He looked around just long enough to reassure himself of the spot's suitability for landing, then nodded to the senior of the quartet of coxswains.
"This'll do," he said quietly. "Head back for the next lot."
"Aye, sir."
The petty officer had a Chisomian accent, Garvai noticed. Now the coxswain looked thoughtfully at the gentle waves rolling up onto the shingle.
"Tide's going to stop making in another half hour or so, General," he said. "Be at least twice that long till I can get the next load ashore. Might be you and your lads are going to find yourselves waiting afore that happens."
"If we do, we do," Garvai shrugged. "The good news,"
he twitched his head at one of the pier's pilings and the necklace of high-water shellfish and weeds which encircled it,
"is that it's not going to get a lot more than knee-deep, even when the tide's all the way back in. Not that we won't appreciate your moving things right along."
"Oh, of course, sir," the coxswain chuckled. "We'll do that little thing."
"Good."
Garvai's teeth flashed in a smile, so white it was dimly visible, even in the pier's shadow. Then he smacked the coxswain on the shoulder.
"In that case, though," he said a bit pointedly, "I suppose you'd best get started."
The coxswain's estimate turned out to have been almost uncannily accurate. The sort of offhand precision 20 or 30 years' experience at sea could provide. The water was little more than ankle-deep by the time all four boats came sliding silently out of the night once more, although the guardsmen had been standing there long enough to demonstrate that none of their boots were truly watertight. Garvai could feel the cold water squishing around his own toes, seeming to swirl a bit, even inside his boots, as small wavelets slopped across the shingle. It wasn't the most pleasant sensation he'd ever experienced. On the other hand, he could think of quite a few which had been worse, and few of them had come his way in such a good cause.
Captain says Captain Porter's first lot made it ashore all right, and tight too, General,"
the Chisomian coxswain said softly, as the second load of guardsmen climbed out of the boats.
"Reckon his second lot'll be going ashore in about another 15-20 minutes.
"Good," Garvey said again. He looked around as Major Niklos, who'd been promoted to command his own battalion since the Manchir raid, and Alston got things organized. He considered what the coxswain had said and the street map which had come with the letter. He compared overland distances from his current position to his objective, then considered how long it would take Porter to reach his primary objective. Allow another 15 minutes or so for slippage, and...
"All right, Frank," he said quietly, his mouth a foot from Niklos's ear. "It's time we got them started moving. Your scouts have their bearings?"
"Yes, sir,"
Niklos replied equally quietly, and grinned tightly.
"And they're good men, too. As a matter of fact, Yeoman picked them."
"I figured he would," Garvey snorted, giving his armsmen a look of affectionate exasperation.
"Give him an inch and he'll take a mile, Major. Never has known his place."
"Now you know that's not true, sir," Alston said. "Know my place perfectly, I do, right here."
He pointed at the water slopping over the shingle, approximately 2 feet behind Sir Corin Garvey.
"As for the rest, well..."
The armsman shrugged with the confidence of a trusted family henchman, and Garvey shook his head.
"All right, Major," he said resignedly. "If Yeoman's deign to sign off on the suitability of your scouts, let's move out."
In point of fact, Major Niklos's scouts did their job perfectly. They'd had ample opportunity to study a copy of the map which had come with Garvey's letter. Their copy omitted all of the detailed information whose origin would have been difficult to explain, but it was more than sufficient for them to pick up their landmarks as they circled around the harbor district. Garvey's men moved through the shadows of warehouses, avoiding the glow of lanterns where still-open taverns served their customers. The lead scouts were far enough ahead to spot even the occasional prostitutes before they could notice that the better part of 300 guardsmen were slipping through the darkened streets of Talitha. Most of those prostitutes, and the handful of other pedestrians who fell into the scouts' clutches, were more than a little uneasy to find themselves requested to accompany Garvey's troopers. None were foolish enough to mistake the politeness of the invitation as an indication that they had any choice, however, and one look at the grim-faced guardsman was enough to convince any of them to keep his or her mouth shut, rather than risk raising the alarm. They might not know exactly what Garvey and his men were up to, but they knew enough to be certain it was none of their business, whatever it was. Despite his own careful planning, and despite the experience of the scouts Niklos and Ulston had chosen, Garvey was actually surprised when they managed to get all the way to their initial objective without raising a single alarm. Aside from a handful of dogs who'd taken exception to their presence, and the handful of involuntary fellow travelers they'd swept up along the way, no one in the entire city seemed to have taken the least note of their presence.
"Doesn't say much for the local guards' alertness," Garvey mused. "Not that I'm going to complain about it, tonight at least. But Langhorn, I knew we were taking precautions, but I have to wonder if these clowns would have noticed us if I'd come in with a brass band and a torchlight parade."
On the other hand, he supposed Earl Stormkeep and his fellow conspirators might have been discouraging the city guard from noticing anything they weren't supposed to notice.
"In fact," he thought slowly, "maybe we aren't the first bunch of armed men to be creeping around in the middle of the night. If they've been working on this as long as our letter-writing friend says they have, they may have marched quite a few men through Talitha to collect arms from the warehouses here. That could explain why all the locals are being so careful to avoid noticing us.
That thought made him even more grateful for the 10 additional transports and the 6 escorting war galleons, which ought to be about 5 miles out at the moment. Of course, they'd hoped for a bit more wind when they were laying their plans, and it was entirely possible their reinforcements, an entire regiment each of Imperial Marines and Coruscantian Guardsmen, were going to be delayed.
"Well, if everything goes the way it's supposed to, we won't need reinforcements," he encouraged himself, resolutely not thinking about how seldom everything actually did go the way it was supposed to. He wished he had a better notion of exactly how Porter was doing, but timing was actually less critical than it might have been. Porter's objective was, ultimately, as important as Garvai's. But unlike Garvai, Porter was supposed to be pouncing on a mostly empty, or at least currently unoccupied, building. Garvai's objective, on the other hand, was most definitely occupied. Which, considering who the occupants were, was the real reason it had been assigned to a completely Coruscantian force. He peered down the boulevard at the luxurious walled mansion. Like the city itself, Stormhouse was a fairly recent construction, no more than 50 years old, and it had little in common with old-fashioned fortified seats like Baron Larchros's manor in Cerebor, or for that matter, even Earl Craggy Hill's residence in Velena. It had lots of doors and windows, and very little in the way of built-in defensive features. The wall around Stormhouse, no more than 7 or 8 feet tall, was more for privacy than protection, although it was probably enough to at least delay any intruders, especially if anyone behind it knew the intruders were coming. According to the letter, which had been delivered to his study, Stormkeep had no more than a couple of dozen armed retainers here in his townhouse. Talitha might be his city, but there was a limit to just how openly he dared to operate, even here. On the other hand, Garvai had to assume any retainers he did keep here knew all about his plans and were fully committed to them, which suggested they might well offer resistance, especially if they didn't immediately realize just how outnumbered they actually were. And it wouldn't take a great deal of delay for the really important fish to slither out of the net before he could scoop them up.
"Get your second company in position, Major," he whispered to Niklos,
and heard the Major's own murmured order being relayed from man to man. A few moments later, the designated company moved off, gratifyingly quietly, and he settled back down in the shadows, waiting. He gave the moving company long enough to get into its pre-chosen position, covering the back side of the townhouse from the spacious park attached to it, then waited that long again as a cushion. Only then did he turn back to Niklos and nod.
"Go," he said simply.
The first inkling any occupant of Stormhouse had that something untoward was happening was the sudden, voiceless rush of booted feet on cobblestones. It was understandable that it should take at least a few seconds for anyone to recognize that sound, especially when it came out of absolutely nowhere in the middle of the darkest night of the month. The pair of armsmen assigned to the gate were reasonably alert, but they'd never actually expected to be assailed here in the middle of the Earl's own city. The idea was preposterous. And so, even after their instincts had begun to recognize what they were hearing, their brains insisted they had to be wrong. There must be some other explanation. Unfortunately, there wasn't. And perhaps even more unfortunately, Sir Corin Garvai's instructions to his guardsmen had been very clear. No one was to be allowed to raise the alarm. As a consequence, the Earl's armsmen were neutralized with a maximum of efficiency and a minimum of gentleness, while they were still trying to figure out what that other explanation was. Still, the guardsmen weren't actually trying to kill them, and both of them recovered consciousness within 2 days. As the gate guards went down under vigorously applied guard musket butts, Garvai and the bulk of his men went flooding into Stormhouse's courtyard. There was some jostling as they funneled through the constricting gate, but this was the same company Garvai had selected for the raid which had netted Adrian Wyman. By now, they'd become experts at raiding monasteries or townhouses in the middle of the night, and they'd been even more carefully briefed tonight than they'd been that night. As soon as they were clear of the gate, they spread out once more, individual squads heading for individual objectives, under their sergeants. Bishop Executor Thomas Schiller had been delighted to accept Earl Stormkeep's invitation to visit Talitha. While he was confident of Earl Craggy Hill's security in Velena, Schiller was of the opinion that it was better to stay on the move. Allowing himself to loiter too long in any one location was too likely to give some potential informant the chance to recognize him, however secure his hiding place might appear, or even actually be. Craggy Hill had disagreed, arguing that it was wiser for him to find a single, really safe hiding place. Obviously, in Craggy Hill's opinion, in Velena, and then simply stay there. If he never went out, Craggy Hill had reasoned, the chance of someone recognizing him would be non-existent. Schiller could appreciate the logic, but there were 4 telling points against it, in his opinion. First, wherever he set up his headquarters, there was going to be a steady flow of messengers and visitors in and out. It had to be that way if he was going to stay in contact with the Princedom's Temple Loyalist clergy. All that traffic was likely to draw attention sooner or later if he stayed in one place, whether or not anyone realized he himself was present. Second, he simply wasn't prepared to stay cooped up in a single suite of rooms, no matter how luxurious, for literally months on end. He had to get out, breathe at least a little fresh air, and moving about, cautiously, between the residences of the senior members of the Resistance, was the best way to stay on top of the situation. Third, he was uneasy about trusting men with whom he had no personal contact. He wanted to see them, look them in the eye, listen to the firmness of their voices. And, in his opinion, it was safer for one man and his personal aide, him, to move around discreetly than it would have been for all of the others to come to him. And fourth, though he was unprepared to discuss this one with any of his secular allies, he had less than absolute faith in the selflessness of Craggy Hill's motives. For that matter, he nursed at least some suspicion about the altruism of all of those allies, which meant he had no desire to find himself as the permanent guest of, and just coincidentally, under the physical control of, any of them. His own logic was not universally accepted, yet there wasn't a great deal anyone could do about it. Schiller suspected his fellow conspirators had recognized that, and organized their own schedule of invitations as the best compromise available to them, but that was fine with him. He didn't mind being managed a bit, as long as he did have the opportunity to avoid permanent incarceration. Of all of the townhouses and manors in which he'd been a guest since fleeing Manchir, Stormhouse was his favorite. It was the newest and most modern. The rooms assigned to him had a magnificent beachside view, and he loved the climate here. The soothing sound of surf helped him to sleep as well, and that was what he was doing, deeply and peacefully, at the moment Sir Corin Garvai's guardsmen put the Stormhouse gate guards into an even deeper slumber than his own. Less than 3 minutes later, however, the Bishop Executor's repose found itself rudely interrupted. Solomon Tregear, the Earl of Stormkeep, was sound asleep, snoring peacefully beside his wife, when something penetrated his slumber. Unfortunately for the Earl, while Stormhouse might not have been designed as a fortress, it was solidly built. In fact, it had intentionally been constructed with an eye towards holding down noise from the nearby city streets, especially in the Earl's personal apartments and bedchamber, and that same noise-baffling design meant the muffled sound wasn't loud enough to actually wake him. His sleeping brain roused a bit, trying to identify it, but before the fish of consciousness reached the surface of his sleeping mind's pool, the door to his bedchamber burst violently open. Stormkeep bolted up into a sitting position even as his wife screamed and clutched at the blankets.
"What the hell?"
he began thunderously.
"Earl Stormkeep," a flat, cold voice interrupted him. "I arrest you on the charge of treason and conspiracy against the crown."
Stormkeep froze, mouth still open, as he recognized that icy voice. A flood of adrenaline brought him fully awake, but his brain was still slithering across a surface of shock, like a man trying to find his feet on the surface of a frozen lake. He blinked against the light streaming from the open slides of three bullseye lanterns, and as he looked past Sir Corin Garvai, he saw half a dozen of Garvai's guardsmen and the lantern light glinting on the razor edges of their bayonets. Bishop Executor Thomas was in the midst of a dream, inspired by the surf sound coming to him even in his sleep, no doubt, of a sunny day on one of the beaches outside Manchir, when the door to his bedchamber flew open. He was also a sounder sleeper than Earl Stormkeep. He sat up, blinking in the sudden light, startled, yet too sleep-sodden and groggy to feel truly alarmed.
"What?"
he started.
"Thomas Chalair,"
a voice said, and even in his confused sleepiness, a corner of Chalair's rousing brain noticed the absence of any ecclesiastic title.
"I arrest you on a charge of treason and conspiracy."
3. Imperial Palace, City of Talisburg, Kingdom of Old Karras.
"So it went well, did it?" Sir Regis Yowance asked.
"Yes, my lord, very well," Merlin Athrawis replied with a smile. He and Earl Grey Harbor were alone in the Earl's office in Talisburg Palace, and despite his smile, Merlin found himself once again regretting the fact that they dared not tell Grey Harbor the entire truth. He knew it bothered Caleb and Charlian as well, just as it bothered them in Baron Green Mountain's case. It wasn't simply that not telling their two most senior counselors prevented them from getting the best out of two very able men's advice and counsel either. What really bothered them, and Merlin, was that they felt as if they were sneaking around behind the backs of men who were also friends, confidants. In Green Mountain's case, a second father even, at least in Charlian's case. Because of that, Merlin was particularly happy Grey Harbor, at least, knew about Sajan Merlin's visions. The Earl had also adjusted quite well to the notion that there might be additional Sajans scattered around Safehold. He even accepted Merlin's explanation, truthful as far as it went, that all those other Sajans and Merlin himself were part of an organization which had been carefully concealed for many years. Merlin figured 900 years qualified as many, and given how many personalities he seemed to be developing, calling himself an owl an organization didn't seem too outrageous, until its members finally believed there was an opportunity to do something about the church's corruption. Of course, there weren't a huge number of those Sajans, but his acceptance of their existence had let him take things like the suddenly increased reasonableness of King Gorja's clandestine correspondence in stride. It had also prepared him to accept that Merlin's associates in Coruscant were in a position to tell Anvil Rock and Vice General Cherman when the proper time to move against the Northern Conspiracy arrived. and he didn't have any problem accepting Merlin's vision of how well the raid had gone.
"I'm glad," Merlin thought affectionately as he smiled at the First Counselor. "And not just because it means we can call on his insight where both Coruscant and Taro are concerned, either. I like Regis, and this feels good."
"So they got Stormkeep and Chalair," Grey Harbor said now, leaning back in his chair with a smile of his own. In fact, he actually allowed himself to rub his hands together in satisfaction, and Merlin chuckled.
"Garvai and his men took both of them into custody," he confirmed. "I think he and Howell were wise to decide he'd do most of the arresting, at least of our more prominent suspects, too. It gave the rest of Stormkeep's supporters a lot less chance to whip up some kind of resistance to the Carizian oppressors before their reinforcements could land. Of course, it helped that they had a list of all of the more important supporters actually in Talitha." His smile turned into a rather nasty grin. "They grabbed almost all of them in the first pounce as well."
"And the weapons?"
"Major Porter secured the warehouses without firing a shot, and the rifles were still in the Zebedean shipping crates, even if the crates were labeled as general hardware. Funny how the cargo and custom manifests in both Talitha and Zebediah didn't catch that little error."
"A most unfortunate oversight, I'm sure," Grey Harbor agreed with a grin which was just as nasty as Merlin's.
"And it's going to be most unfortunate for Zebediah in oh so many ways," Merlin thought cheerfully. "The customs manifests, his correspondence with Craggy Hill and Earl Swale, and that unfortunate business with the serial numbers."
The one real problem with going after Stormkeep first had been that while the weapons had been landed in Talitha, Zebediah's incriminating correspondence was still in Craggy Hill safe in Valena. On the other hand, Valena was far enough inland that any operation against Craggy Hill would have to be mounted overland, with, unfortunately, ample time for him to realize it was coming. Since it would be virtually impossible to achieve surprise in his case, Caleb and Charlian had decided it was more important to scoop up the weapons before they could be dispersed, especially if they could grab Chalair at the same time. They'd recognized that Craggy Hill would almost certainly learn what had happened in Talitha in time to dispose of any incriminating documents before he himself could be arrested, but they'd been willing to accept that for several reasons. One was the importance of getting their hands on Chalair and seizing the weapons, but another was that they didn't really need the correspondence between Craggy Hill and Zebediah to prove the Grand Duke's complicity. Edward Hausman had adopted a novel practice which had since spread to the majority of old Carizian manufactories, assigning serial numbers to items he produced. It had been customary for centuries to use maker's marks, and arbalists, matchlocks, and artillery pieces had carried proof marks as well. But Hausman, at the suggestion of a certain Sajan Merlin, had begun stamping actual serial numbers into things like musket barrels, sword blades, breastplates, and cannon. In fact, he'd extended the practice to everything he manufactured. That had never been very practical before Merlin introduced Arabic numerals, which helped explain why no one had ever done it before, and why no one had ever considered tracking inventory by recording serial numbers. That practice had now been generally introduced throughout the Carizian military, and it was beginning to spread to civilian goods, but some people, like Earl Swale and Grand Duke Zebediah, were a little slow to realize the implications. Like the minor fact that it would be possible for prosecutors to demonstrate in any court of law that the weapons seized in Talitha had passed directly through Swale's and Zebediah's hands before reaching their destination.
"We don't need any correspondence promising to provide them when we already have proof he did provide them sitting in front of the judge," Merlin thought with profound satisfaction. "For that matter,
It doesn't really matter if Craggy Hill destroys the originals of all his documents. I've already got perfect duplicates, right down to the odd ink blot tucked away, and somehow I don't think Caleb or Charlian, or even Michael, would have any great qualms about introducing them into evidence as the originals. And if we do, what good is it going to do Craggy Hill to protest that they can't possibly be the originals because he personally burned the originals before they could have been seized? I think we can safely assume Caleb's deviousness has paid off in Zebediah's case, he said out loud, and Gray Harbor chuckled. He always was such a clever boy, the first counselor agreed, remembering Merlin's report of a conversation between him and the Emperor aboard HMS Empress of Caris, anchored in the waters of Hannah Bay. He was he? I wonder who taught him to be that devious, Merlin mused. I'm sure I wouldn't know, Gray Harbor replied in his most innocent tone. Of course you wouldn't. Merlin shook his head, then his expression grew more serious. The question in my mind, now that Zebediah's fulfilled Caleb's prediction and given him an unambiguous justification for removing him, is who he and Charlian will replace Zebediah with. I can think of several possible replacements, Gray Harbor said. At the moment, though, I think the leading contender is Howell Cherman. Merlin blinked in surprise, then castigated himself for feeling it. Cherman was about the least politically ambitious person he could think of, and he certainly didn't have much experience with court politics. Or at least he hadn't had much. Given his responsibilities in Coruscant, that wasn't really the case any longer. And given how well he'd discharged those responsibilities, he was a logical choice for Zebediah as well. Not only had he amply earned consideration for the position of the island's senior noble, but his performance in Coruscant would give him plenty of experience when it came to establishing his own authority in Zebediah. And the fact that he did his job so well in Coruscant is going to make any Zebedian who might think about resisting the outsider think twice, or even three or four times for that matter. Actually, I think that's an excellent idea, my lord, Merlin said out loud. Then he laughed again. Of course, Howell will probably consider cutting his own throat if Caleb and Charlian do nominate him as the new Grand Duke. He may think about it, but he won't do it, Gray Harbor replied. In fact, once he gets over the initial shock, I think he'll probably adjust quite nicely to the notion of becoming a great and very wealthy noble. And having Zebediah in the hands of someone absolutely trustworthy would take a huge load off Caleb's and Charlian's minds. Not exactly a minor factor in my own thinking, Gray Harbor agreed. The Earl drummed the fingers of his right hand lightly on his desktop, looking off into space and obviously considering the situation in Coruscant and Zebediah. Then he gave himself a shake. I have to say, at the risk of tempting fate, that things are looking up, he said. I hate what happened to Admiral Manthir, but on the political front, this has been a very good month. Anvil Rock and Howell are in the process of ripping the guts out of the only serious, organized conspiracy in Coruscant. Zebediah's for the long drop in Carmen, whether he knows it or not. Swale and his little clutch of friends in Coruscant are about to go the same way. And our friend Gorja has effectively accepted their Majesty's terms for inclusion in the Empire. He nodded slowly, and his eyes refocused on Merlin. With Taro in hand, we've secured the Empire's natural frontiers, he said, and there was no hiding the satisfaction or the relief in his voice. I don't think Clintan and Trenaire are going to be at all pleased to hear about that. No, Merlin agreed. No, I don't imagine they will. 4. The Temple, City of Zion, the Temple Lands. All right, Jaspar, we're all here now, so suppose you tell us what this is all about.
Zamson Trenaire put what he hoped was a precisely metered bite into his tone. Over the last few months, he'd come to feel more and more like an animal trainer who specialized in man-eating beasts. And, like the animal trainer, he found it necessary to never show fear, to occasionally remind Clinton that the Grand Inquisitor wasn't the only one with a temple power base, and that Trenaire remained confident of his control of the temple hierarchy. Whether or not he was succeeding in convincing Clinton of that was a bit more problematical.
"Actually, Zamson, I was rather hoping you might be able to shed a little illumination on a disturbing rumor which has reached my attention," Clinton said now, and his tone was dangerously affable.
"What sort of rumor?" Trenaire asked, just a bit guardedly.
"Well, I realize that as Chancellor, you're in charge of Mother Church's diplomacy, but according to Father Franklin, Gorgia of Taro seems to be losing some of his zeal for Mother Church's struggle."
"What?" Trenaire straightened in his chair, eyebrows lowering.
"I just had a report from Narth last 5 day. He didn't report anything untoward."
Robert Duquesne watched impassively as Clinton smiled at Trenaire. It was unpleasant, that smile, but Duquesne had grown accustomed to that, just as he'd grown accustomed to Clinton's smirking satisfaction at the way the rest of the vicarate had come obediently to heel. So far, he seemed to have restricted his most unseemly displays to the circle of his immediate subordinates and his colleagues in the group of four. Some days, Duquesne hoped he would continue to be at least that discreet. Other days, he longed for Clinton's mask to slip where every other surviving vicar could see it.
"The problem is that even if it does slip, it won't tell anyone anything they don't already know. Jaspar may not gloat openly yet, but that doesn't mean there's anyone left who isn't perfectly well aware of how he truly feels."
For his own part, Duquesne had completely stopped deferring to Clinton. He didn't go out of his way to provoke the Grand Inquisitor, but he'd made his indifference to Clinton clear. Not surprisingly, the Inquisitor had responded with profound disdain and contempt. Yet he seemed curiously loath to actually attack Duquesne. He wasn't even needling the treasurer the way he once had. It was clear to Duquesne that Clinton had accepted the bargain he'd proposed by way of Trenaire. It was even remotely possible the Grand Inquisitor actually understood the necessity for Mother Church to show a kinder, more caring face, rather than relying solely upon the mailed fist, the whip, and terror.
"More likely, he's simply satisfied I'm either too terrified of him to challenge him, or else that I've become such a bleeding heart I no longer really care about worldly power. It may even be a combination of the two. At any rate, he seems to have taken my declaration of neutrality at face value, so far at least, which probably means I'm beneath contempt now, as far as he's concerned."
If that was Clinton's attitude, it suited Duquesne just fine. Not that he intended to take any stupid, overly optimistic chances. Behind his impassive facade, however, the treasurer found himself wondering what Clinton was up to this time. Father Franklin Sumir, the church's intendant in Taro, was a Schulerite, like almost all intendants. As such, he reported directly to the Inquisition, although any report touching on political affairs was supposed to be copied to Trenaire's office in the Chancellery as well. Bishop Executor Turner Narth, on the other hand, was supposed to report to Archbishop Felix Garber, the Archbishop of Taro, whose deputy he officially was. Of course, he was also supposed to be copying his reports to the Chancellery as well. Theoretically, then, Trenaire should have been informed about anything which had reached Clinton's ears. Which, obviously, was not the case.
"I'm not really surprised Narth didn't mention anything about it," Clinton said now, almost carelessly. Probably not his fault, really. I mean, I know he's our official representative in Taro, and that he's been conferring regularly with Gorja, so I'm sure he's confident he's on top of the situation.
But you're suggesting he isn't on top of it, correct? Trenaire asked sharply.
Oh, I'm sure he's fully conversant with all the diplomatic correspondence and negotiations, all that sort of thing. But according to Father Franklin, there's been a mysterious drop in Carisian naval activity in Thole Bay. As a matter of fact, the entire Carisian blockade seems to have suddenly become about as watertight as a fishnet.
Excuse me. Trenaire's puzzlement was obvious, and Clinton snorted.
We already know Gorja changed sides once, he said in the tone of a man explaining something to a very young child in very simple words. We also know, despite any investigations which might have cleared him, that only someone in Taro could have warned Harald of what was about to happen. I've always wondered just who could have had the authority and reach to both pass that information along and make certain no one was ever able to identify him as the source. Of course, as the rest of you have pointed out, we can't just go around deposing kings and princes on suspicion, can we?
Jaspar, if you were really convinced Gorja was the leak, you should have said so at the time. There was a pronounced edge of asperity in Trenaire's voice. Your own inquisitors conducted the investigation, at his request, I remind you. If they turned up any evidence that you failed to share with us, I suggest you tell us about it now.
If I'd had any such evidence, I would have shared it with you then, Clinton said coolly. Obviously I didn't. But riddle me this, Jason. Why should the Carisian suddenly begin going easy on Taro? After locking that damned island up tight, sticking it in a cask and then driving in the bung for the better part of 2 years? Why is their blockade suddenly so porous? You know as well as I do that that bastard Rockpoint's been basing himself inside Thole Bay. Frankly, I've always found it just a bit suspicious that Gorja and his precious white Ford weren't even able to keep him from doing that. But now, all of a sudden, blockade runners are managing to slip past the eagle-eyed Carisians in droves.
You're suggesting Gorja's negotiated some sort of secret arrangement with Caleb and Charlian?
Trenaire and Clinton both looked at Ducairn as he asked the question. His own expression was one of indifference, almost boredom, and there might actually have been a hint of amusement in his tone.
That's exactly what I'm suggesting, Robert, Clinton said after a moment. You find the idea humorous?
Oh, by no means, Ducairn said calmly. What I do find a bit amusing, though, is that you and Zamson, I suppose, should be more concerned with scoring points off of one another here in the council chamber than in keeping all of us fully informed on whatever information comes into our hands.
Trenaire's eyebrows rose. Clinton's didn't, and an ugly light flickered in his eyes. He started to open his mouth, but then he stopped. He glowered at Ducairn for a moment, and then, to Trenaire's surprise, he actually chuckled.
Point taken, the Grand Inquisitor said, and turned his gaze to Trenaire. Robert's right, and I'll admit there's a part of me that wants to rub everyone else's nose in it, if it turns out Gorja really is turning his coat again. Because the truth is I never did trust the slimy little bastard, and I did let myself be overruled by the rest of you. So yes, I guess I would take a certain satisfaction if it turns out I was right about him. Which, as Robert has just pointed out, isn't really all that smart of me.
Trenaire managed not to blink, although the sight of Jaspar Clinton in reasonable mode wasn't one that had come along all that often of late. I don't imagine any of us are really at our best these days, the Chancellor said after a moment. I know I'm not, at any rate. And you're right, Narth didn't mention anything about blockade runners. To be fair, though, matters of trade and shipping have always been rather outside his area of expertise.
I know,
Clinton waved one hand.
In fact, I knew it when I was twisting your tail. But my point stands. I think we have to take this sudden shipping upsurge in and around Taro seriously. I think it's possible, even probable, that Gorja has worked out some sort of under-the-table deal with Caleb.
What sort of a deal? Ducairn asked.
I don't know,
Clinton said thoughtfully, pursing his lips.
It could be something as simple as an unofficial effective neutrality. Or it could indicate he was the one who passed our original plans along and that he's reopened that channel of communications. In either of those cases, the Carizians might let enough shipping through to ease his own shortages without either side making any official admission about what they were up to.
But what you're really afraid of is that he's becoming a second Narman, Trenaire said.
Yes.
Clinton shrugged his beefy shoulders.
That would be the most damaging thing he could do to us, at any rate. So, on the theory that it's best to assume the worst, that's exactly what I'm afraid he's doing.
In that case, why don't we arrest him?
Elaine Maguire asked. All three of the others turned to look at the temple's captain general, and Maguire raised his hands a bit defensively.
I mean, if we're afraid he's going to betray us, why not have the Inquisition take him into custody while we investigate?
Under other circumstances, that might not be such a terrible idea, Elaine, Trenaire said almost gently. If Gorja's really planning on emulating Narman, though, and if his plans are so far along that Caleb and Charlian have already eased their blockade, we have to assume Gorja's also following Narman's example in terms of covering his back. Let's face it, that far from Zion, the Inquisition relies more on its moral authority and its power to require the secular authorities to support Mother Church rather than on the Temple Guard. You know, better than anyone else probably, that we've never had anything remotely like enough guardsmen to cover everything that needs to be covered all over the world. I doubt there are more than a couple hundred guardsmen in all of Taro. So if Gorja has a few thousand men who are prepared to follow his orders and defy Mother Church, actually arresting him would be almost impossible.